extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Wow, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental from Kansas City. I'm Andrew Wiebe with my partner in soccer, two-man show, one-twos, Wiebe to Goss, back to Wiebe, in on goal. Oh, yes!
I thought you were going to pretend you missed.
Really?
I thought that was going to be the bit, yeah. But it doesn't matter, because we've got the guy who's going to tuck it home for us.
Yes.
Yeah, coming up later.
Exactly.
That's why we have to have quality on the show.
Patrice will find the back of the net for me. And you know what? He will, like, he'll pat my back. He'll say, ah, you know what, Wiebe? Next time, man. Next time. I got your back, okay?
It's
I got
all about
your back.
Player development.
He'll build me up, okay? Yeah. If you're listening on SiriusXMFC right now, thank you. We are so happy to be here. It is a new thing for us, new old thing. Yeah, we used to be here. We're back, and now we're really enjoying it. If you
the
listen,
last time we were on Sirius Radio, just so everyone knows, Weeby's undershirt was showing outside of his bowl cut haircut and his Eddie Bauer button downs that he bought at Kirkland brand. Otherwise, one of those two.
Do not.
Yeah, it's been a little while.
Don't dare slander Kirkland brand. Yeah. All right. But yes, I did have
a phase. Quite a lot of it right now.
About 10 years ago that was unearthed on Twitter last night. That was, it's shameful. But if you live your professional life publicly, those moments are going to happen to you. If you're listening on Sirius, please subscribe and rate. If you're not listening on Sirius, please subscribe and rate. That's how we grow the podcast. If you like the podcast, go tell your friends. If your friends like MLS, there's a pretty good chance they might like this podcast. That would be awesome. Today's show, you mentioned it.
And if they don't, but they play professional soccer in another country, give them the podcast. And then in 3 years, like our guy Bjorn Janssen, he may come to this league. So you never know.
That's right. We're basically scouts.
Yeah.
That's like in a different roundabout way. Legend de foot. On this show, Patrice Bernier is going to stop by here to tell some MLS stories, whether that be Nacho Piatti or Didier Drogba or that CCL final against Club America, or maybe even that 2016 Eastern Conference insanity against Toronto FC. Look out for that. He will help us do our top five D mids and fullbacks. We are going to do top five at every position in Major League Soccer ahead of the 2021 season. You losing hair over
hair?
It?
I lost this over these top five lists. These are stressing me out. Because I want to give respect, and it's too hard. Can't get no respect.
In the mailbag, we are going to try to name a rivalry earlier than it should be named. That is Austin FC Dallas. Maybe it doesn't deserve a name. We'll debate that one, and we'll decide who is going to break their MLS Cup duck, because there's a bunch of teams that have never won it. If you don't listen to the call-up, you should do so. They had Darren Eels on their most recent show. Really fun one. And if you want to go check out MLSsoccer.com, my MVP candidates for every single team, it is there. And Charlie Boehm also has a great piece on Kai Kamara, who is still looking for a team. Still a free agent. Producing Anders, reminder of the day before we get to Daryl DK, and another goal for him in the championship. Producing Anders says, support your local soccer media. Extra Time cannot possibly cover every single team on every single show because, as you know, we hate your team. So find the people who do cover your club and click on their work. Engage with them on Twitter. Subscribe to whatever they're doing, however they're doing it. And I can say this definitively. Extra Time would not exist. We would not be able to do this show without all those people. With all the people in the markets and all the people doing national work, I'm not going to say we steal your work. I'm going to say you help us become better experts, and sometimes we borrow a few things. But we are reading, we are watching, we are listening. Thank you for doing what you're doing. And everybody was talking, Dave, about that Daryl DK goal. Another one, this one against QPR. Jeff Cameron on the other side, he was not marking on the corner kick that Daryl dunked home in the 23rd minute. Daryl tweeted afterwards, the number six, which is interesting because that's the number of wins in a row for Barnsley, who are now seventh in the championship. Daryl DK is basically, he's in that lineup. He is the starting forward. He is a menace. He's starting to get goals. And we have a question from Travis that says, how come Daryl DK is the best American to step foot in Europe? Maybe not that. But my question to you is, should Orlando City fans just accept it now? because Oscar Pareja said this to Julie Poe at the Sentinel the other day. Quote, Daryl's spot is here in Orlando. I think he's done great in his career so far, and we're waiting on Daryl to compete with us this year, 2021. Well, it sounds like he's coming back, right? He's
lock it in.
He's going back to MLS, baby. But, Oscar also said if something exceptional happens, if some door gets open for him, then we'll have to just accept it and put that as a good path for others, especially youngsters here in the club. So what Oscar's saying is, like, make an offer. That's what it sounds like to me. Is Daryl DK going to be back in Orlando, or did we just get that little taste and off to Europe he goes?
I don't think it's locked in that he's off to Europe. And he's played phenomenally, and the team's done well. As you said, he's scoring goals. He's been the central piece of their attack since he's gotten there, which is amazing for someone who didn't play pro soccer a year and a half ago in his entire life, right? And we had him on this show. He was awesome, so I'm a huge fan of his. But also he talked about not coming through a pro academy, being in Oklahoma, the way it's kind of worked for him. So it shows you, one, these players still exist, and two, how quickly he can kind of like get comfortable and get into a situation. I don't think it's locked in because if Barnsley don't get promoted, you'd assume they will struggle to buy him for the number he wants. And with the way the world is, I wouldn't be surprised if he comes back to Orlando and plays a little bit before that right offer comes through. I don't know that it's immediately Barnsley's season's end and the offer comes in. And I don't know that he takes off if that's what happens, right? So I think he comes back to Orlando, maybe plays a little this summer. Then you look at going into the next season where the deals are at, or he plays the rest of this year and he goes in January. So I don't think it's locked in that if he scores a goal in the championship, it's over for him to ever play in Orlando. Either way, you can tell from Oscar Pereja's quote, it's a win-win. There's literally no way for him to lose in this for anyone. It's either DK plays well, Orlando makes money, they put themselves back into the market as a selling club, and they show the next generation of players, this is what we can do for you. Or Daryl DK plays for Orlando City, and he's in the national team conversation, and Orlando's in an MLS Cup conversation, which is a pretty good spot to be in.
There's one scenario that's not a good scenario, and I'm not going to say out loud what that scenario might be. We have some recent experience with that scenario with loans to the championship and things that can happen.
Don't do that,
happen.
Go outside.
I have a wooden desk. I'm pounding on it right now. I do want to quibble with one thing. You said that Daryl was the centerpiece? It all revolved around him in Orlando. How did you phrase that?
Because
sure.
In Barnsley.
Oh, in Barnsley. Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Like he has, it's not like he's like, oh, he's been good, but our star players carry the team and he's kind of chipped in, sort of what Jordan Morris was doing for a little bit at Swansea. Like, this attack runs through him. Everything's direct to him. Everything's off his feet, off his head. So, yeah, that's what I meant.
Okay. I agree with that 100%. The thing that's most impressive for me with Daryl DK is the speed at which he has figured out how to adapt in the professional game. And you kind of mentioned it there. But he didn't play for Oscar Pareja for Orlando City for months. Just didn't play. This high draft pick, we're like, where's Daryl DK? Where's Daryl DK? You guys need a center forward. You're talking about going out and signing a center forward. Why don't you just try Daryl DK? They finally did, and it worked in spades. Immediately, he hit the field. He was successful. It wasn't always perfect. There were still some little moments where you're like, that probably should be better. But it was well over good enough immediately. And then he gets to Barnsley into a completely new scenario, new country, no preseason for him. He's not a part of the squad. He's just being thrown into a team on loan without that runway. As you said, boom, there he is. That's what is so impressive to me. And if I was a team scouting him, that's what I would like. I would think if I bring him into my team, I don't think he's going to have a huge adaptation process. I think his confidence, I think his life skills, I think his belief in himself are all at a point that would allow him to make that transition. And that's what clubs in Europe need. That's what every club needs. MLS teams going down to Central America, South America, anywhere. They need that. They need that ability to transition quickly. So I just want Daryl to be happy. And I am so happy that he is doing well. Do we think there's any question marks about U.S. national team or Nigeria? We asked him about it.
Yeah, there has to be, because he's happy to play for both. He believes in playing for both. And if he plays this way, he's going to get opportunities on both sides. So it's one of those. And obviously the Yunus Musa rumors come out again, right? There's reason for both sides. And I don't think it's a loss. I think we have to kind of like readjust the way we talk about this if they don't, right? If he feels that he wants to play for Nigeria and he has an opportunity, that doesn't mean Greg Berhalter's staff has done anything wrong. specifically, and the same with Yunus Musa in England or wherever he ends up. So I don't think it's decided either way. And it was good that they got him in camp when they had him here, right?
Yeah.
Because now he goes overseas. Let's say he does sign. It's harder to have that connection with him as he's over there. And then you got all the Nigerians that are playing in England whispering into his ear, which I respect, Super Eagles, all day. So,
plus,
yeah,
you know, plus his brother and sister who got a little bit of a legacy going there, too. And they're like, hey, we can make it three. That could be fun. Yeah. All of us, sibling stuff.
As a younger sibling myself, I can say, lead your own path this way.
Oh.
Don't have to do what they do.
Blaze that new trail. Yeah. Other news for MLSers in Europe, Brendan Aaronson scored in a 4-0 win for Salzburg. Looking real good. I think the one thing with Brendan when I watch him is not necessarily the attacking part of his game right now that I'm just like blown away by every single time. It is his closing speed. And like you saw it with the Union, but you didn't see it as much, I don't think, with Salzburg and under Jesse. It is incredible. It's like, you know, it's like a starting gun in track. When that ball gets played to whoever it is or where, whatever like quadrant of the field he's in and he knows I'm pressing here, he is oppressive. Like, he is on you so fast.
He's causes pressing.
Yeah, that was maybe not my best work right there. But it's like, I can just imagine the moment where the ball's arriving to that player and like, he's already here. Like, mm-hmm. I'm either losing it, he's taking it, or this ball's going out of bounds. So Brendan Aaronson doing well over in Europe as well with Salzburg. Before we get to Patrice, we have a long, long list of MLS news items here. So how about I just throw some out there? You can react. I can react. If we don't care about them or we don't think it's that important, we can just give the news and move on. Freddie Montero headed back to the Seattle Sounders reportedly. I have it on a good account here that producer Anders...
No one in this show cares about that, so let's just move on.
Was crying for joy yesterday. Of course, we know about Freddie. He's got his wife is from Seattle. He still has the coffee shop. He has a home in Seattle. Seattle probably need to make some moves, but would Freddie be the right move? Where does he fit into this team when you have Raul, when you have Will Bruin, who's been sort of that heater off the bench for you?
He's not a starter right now, week in and week out. He still has talent. He has scored goals for Vancouver, and for Seattle, they've done well getting MLS veterans in just to build their depth out, and they're doing it again. So this is the right move, right? He wants to live there. The club needs some more talent, blah, blah, blah. But this doesn't change, you know, the trajectory of any of the clubs he's coming to or leaving in this whole thing.
You don't see it being an impact signing, so to speak?
Not really. I mean, where does he get time? I guess through some summer months. When Raul Ruiz Diaz at World Cup qualifying, Lodeiro is, you know, Roldan's with the national team, whatever it is, he gets you through those. But he's not a guy you're going to rely on, especially for the Seattle Sounders and where they've put themselves in this league. Anders is already upset.
That's I know. Fine. He's yelling at us. He's saying, what about a 3-5-2?
He's going to score only two goals in the middle of July, and Anders is going to come on and say, I told you so, and then he's never going to play again.
He doesn't even really feel to me, and look, slap me down if I'm wrong about this, as an ideal, like, two-man with Ruiz Diaz.
He's developed more dropping deep and creating, and Ruiz Diaz can stretch the line and just lives in the box. He can do that a little bit more, but I still don't think that that's what Seattle's going to play. So I don't know that that totally matters.
All right, how about this? Lautaro Giannetti, he doesn't pass his physical per his reps. They put out a statement on this. Has some knee issues, which is, I mean, it's awful for the player. It's awful for Atlanta United, too, because Giannetti's going to stay with Vélez, and they missed out on their big-time center back. How much does this affect the ceiling or the potential of the five stripes in 2021 in your mind?
A ton, because Meza's already gone on loan to Argentina, and this is the second center back that they've missed out on. And one of the things that I've tried to, you know, figure out in my head is with this year and the biggest thing being COVID, you're not traveling to go see players and meet players. So it feels like, and I think it's right, Atlanta is leaning on Gabriel Heinze's already experience and depth in Argentina. And obviously the club has that as well. You're going to start running out of guys that Heinze already knows and wants that are good enough to play at this level to come in. So then you kind of you end up on a question mark, which isn't what you want for the base of a team with a new coach that's looking to bounce back this year. So I think this is a massive thing for Atlanta United. And right now there's a hole at one of the biggest positions for them. And they've solidified in defensive midfield, which we'll talk about as we get into our top five. with Santiago Sosa, and I think Miles Robinson's going to bounce back. But this was the last piece of this big transfer, you know, this big turnover for this club, and they weren't able to get it done.
So, yeah, it's like Miles Robinson and what now? Because Franco Escobar is gone. He might have been able to push in there, or at least had done so in a three-man center back system there. Yeah, you don't have Meza. So, you have Anton Walks?
For you. Nah, I mean, baby. George Campbell and Efrain Morales, homegrowns. Let's go.
All right. I mean, it's a big question mark. Gabriel Heinze, I got to figure it out. Maybe there's somebody else they can go snatch. Maybe somebody inside the league. Third, fourth level target. They got to be looking at it right now. Houston is actually looking at Carlos Salcedo. It's not just a rumor, and that's from Tommy Scoobs, Tom Bogert. How much is he worth to the Dynamo, do you think? I'm actually not sure that Carlos Salcedo is their biggest need. Like, if I was going to go spend a ton of money on a player as the Houston Dynamo, I'm not sure it would be Carlos Salcedo, given some of the issues that they have in the attack. I think it would probably be, I don't know. I guess they have Quintero and Pico there, and then Bajamich they brought in and under some money from Argentina. They have to be something. Those are more wild cards to me. It's not consistent production. But I was thinking like Parker and either Fuenmayor and Bartlow maybe could do that. But I guess if you want to just say we're going to be like locked down in the back, and over the next 2 years, let's say, we're going to let our young players in the attack develop a little bit, whether that's, hey, can Ariel Lassiter be a game in, game out nine in this league? Other than that, you don't really, and Bajamich is the only other young player. I don't know. It would work. I'm just not sure it's where I would spend that money.
So let's talk about, and I got my Houston Dynamo jersey up. This is not a team that spent huge outside the league on players. And I think that attacking output, especially center forwards, but also tens and wingers, you get what you pay for. So if you go middle of the road, there's a chance it will hit and there's a chance it won't. If you spend big on Lucas Zelarayán or Carlos Vela or Joseph Martinez, you get goals. I don't know that Houston's going to spend that number. And so if you put those resources into a center back you believe in his prime, like Carlos Salcedo, you team him with Tim Parker, you've got Lundqvist. Now you're looking at one of the best back lines in the league, and you can figure it out in the attack, but you're a playoff team. So if they spend the same amount of money at an attacking position as they will, let's assume it comes around a realistic deal, not the rumors that we've heard, for a center back in Salcedo, I think you're getting more bang for your buck. And for a team where it's more realistic, and then you've got that base.
What is the buck? I guess that's what I'm wondering.
What is the total number?
Yeah, what's the buck? What's like between transfer and between salary, what is the buck? Because it's not going to be a small number.
Right. But at the same time, I think Zelarayán was what? A $10 million buy? And then you assume his salary has to be $2 million plus?
Mm-hmm.
I think you're getting half of that. If you're operating in half of that, you can get Carlos Salcedo for sure and put him in your team.
I mean, certainly $10 million is too much. If you're going to spend $10 million, like you said, go get Zelarayán.
100%. Houston has never done that before.
Yeah, fair.
It seems hard. Now, they hit with Elise and they hit with Minotas, but how many other guys have they signed in those positions in different ways that haven't hit?
Yeah.
Because of the numbers you're taking risks at.
And Minotas was a purchase and then let him develop guy. I mean, he wasn't a goal scorer from the jump. Elise had a little bit of a transition period. Tomas Martinez was not the player that they hoped that he was going to be. We shall see with Houston and Carlos Salcedo. It would be very interesting. He would be one of the best center backs in the league, no doubt. How about this one? Sebastian Berhalter loaned with option to trade to Austin FC, reunited with Josh Wolf, who, of course, was the assistant coach with the Crew under his dad, Greg Berhalter. But I really am interested in the loan with the option to trade. I've not heard that one before. So I hope we keep seeing things like that. Also, Austin signed a left back.
I think that. So one of the things is, if you look at Austin FC, right, if you look at an MLS roster, the bottom eight spots are supplemental spots, which not every team fills. But if you can fill them, you get them. And homegrowns is the easiest way to fill those spots. Austin doesn't have an academy yet. So you're about to see this with Charlotte. You're going to see it with St. Louis and whoever else comes in as well. Is they're going to be out hunting for homegrowns from other clubs to bring in to fill those spots. And I think to get something for the loan, because you could loan a player in MLS, but to get allocation money for the right for the loan, I think you have to connect the option to acquire that player later. And so that's what we're going to see coming up.
Mm. Loaned with option to trade. That's some MLS-y stuff for you. All right. Patrice Bernier is on the line. He's a legend at foot. He is no longer an assistant coach with CF Montreal. He is doing his thing on the media side, and we're so happy to have him with us. One of the best friends that we have here in this North American soccer game. Patrice, welcome to Extra Time, man.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me again, guys. Always a pleasure chatting with you guys.
Oh, man. Let's get into it. It was a big anniversary yesterday, the kind of anniversary that Extra Time listeners will celebrate and cherish and mark on the calendar every single year. Montreal Impact, back when they were the Impact, CONCACAF Champions League, Pachuca, Cameron Porter, goal, Frank Klopas thrusting on the field. Let's just start there, Patrice. MLS Storytime, kick it off. Tell me about the Montreal run to the CCL final, but in particular, tell me about that moment in your career, what it was like, what it meant, what people were saying to Cameron Porter in the locker room afterwards. Paint a picture for me.
Yeah, no, yesterday when you revisit these that moment specifically, I was talking to actually Laurent Simaha yesterday, so you're back on the field in a second, because the minute you see that ball played by Caleb Malice, you see the final touch, I'm able to relive those seconds, because it was Irvin Lozano going down the left flank. I think if he makes a better play, they probably go and put the second goal. And then you see Callum pick up the ball, lift up his head, bang. And as I remember, it's like, okay, you have to chest it, trap it correctly, boom. Now he's like, hey, place it. But no, he toe pokes it, goes in between the legs, goes into goal. And then it's just euphoria. We went from, man, we're eliminated. And, oh, my God, we're actually qualified. And then we jump onto the field. I'm pretty sure a lot of us could have deserved some yellow cards, because the whole team was all across the field. And then you have Frank Klopas going at the referees, doing his gestures. It's just, when you talk about sports moments, probably here in Montreal, probably one of differently, if not the biggest, but one of the biggest. And Cameron Porter turned into, who is this guy that we drafted? And now, wait, this guy is a legend for in Montreal sports scenes forever. It was fantastic to relive it yesterday. And we were underdogs, so nobody expected us to do something. We went to Pachuca. We did well. Two goals on the road. But then people were like, you know, Mexican teams, Montreal, a lot of changes in the team at that time too. The big O was in full, so it was 38,000, if I'm correct, but it felt like it was 60,000. It felt like the whole city had just went. And I remember listening to Open Lines after the game, coming home and putting on the radio. You're hearing the people, this is the greatest moment I ever seen. We were out. I didn't know my son. Those are the moments where you go, soccer won that day.
Yeah.
People now who are maybe not soccer fans or Impact or CF Montreal fans, that day they were like, wait a minute, there's something special just happened, and I lived it. I go home and I talk about it. And for me, being from Montreal, Hockey City, we talk about the Canadiens. People talk about that moment as being one of a great sports moment in Montreal history. And for Cameron, yeah, he came into the locker room. And I think Mauro Biel had told him, you know, certain players make their careers off moments. And unfortunately, it didn't go the way we wanted. But you say Cameron Porter here, people will say, yeah, 2015, Pachuca goal.
You have legacies in different ways. I just want you to know, you and every other player of that team, in particular Cameron Porter, who came by the MLS offices and worked for us just a little bit, that my son, my firstborn son's name is Cameron. I won't confirm or deny whether or not that is CCL CONCACAF Champions League inspired, but it is plausible. There's a case to be made. I can't say either way which way it went. Now, 60,000 was the final, though.
Yeah, yeah, against
America. I was in Mexico City. I was in DFA. I saw that match. You guys almost got an incredible result. It was an incredible result. You almost won the game. And then you come back and, man, it was disappointment. There were moments of euphoria. The O was rocking. When you think about your career and that opportunity that was just almost over the line, how do you think about that moment and the difference between first ever CONCACAF Champions League champion and runner-up?
It's a difficult moment. You know, in your career, you love the great moments, but you remember the bad ones, I think, even more. And I remember we went to Azteca Stadium. People were like, oh, yeah, we're going to get pummeled. It's going to be difficult. Club America at home. We come out with a result. We could have had a better result. You know, I think Domo Duro, there's a foul, should have been a red card and all that stuff. And then you start the game, 60,000 at home. You score the first goal, Andres Romero.
Oh, yeah.
We're blazing. I'm like, man, this could be the story where MLS franchise, and especially I'm from Montreal, so I'm like, yes, we're the French-speaking team. Maybe not as the highest profile as TFC or others.
No, this could be our moment. Number one.
This could be our moment. And then I remember Nacho could have had a tap-in, but decided to be Nacho, decided to go with another chop. Didn't score. We go into the locker room 1-0. I'm like, man, if we score a second goal, I think Club America is done. But we're not. In second half, you know, they have a good team. They have Benedetto, who's pummeling goals in Marseille now. And then they score one. They score two. And I was on the bench with Jack McInerney because at the moment, Frank Klobas asked us to go warm up. And I go, nobody knows. Should we go forward? Or should we try to contain the score? And then it was 3-1. And then you could just see the faces of the players after the second goal. You just saw that we're down and out physically. We're down and out mentally. I don't see us coming back into this game because it's like you're a boxer. You've just been put into the sides, and then you're rocking. You don't know what's happening, and then it's 4-1. And then you're like, wait, we were 45 minutes away from being the first MLS team to win this cup. And then you realize that's the difference in quality that Mexican teams have. Even though we could say beginning of the year, they're already somewhat mid-season. It's just they had a little bit more quality where they can bring guys off the bench and it just goes like that. But, it's a difficult moment. As you mentioned it, I was like Club World Cup. And I'm a Barca fan, so I told myself, maybe Barca, play Barca in Club World Cup. You never know. So difficult. And it was at home, 60,000 people. As we live Pachuca, now we live the remorse of saying, wait, we were 45 minutes away, and we could have made history. So.
You're one of the few guys who's played in both CCL and European international competitions, right? Whatever it was called at the time in Champions League and all that stuff. Is there similarities? Is there differences between those competitions, or is CCL so unique?
If you mean in North America, CCL, now I think it's unique here in Montreal, especially because the team participated in 2009 before jumping MLS. So we were underdogs then, and the team was literally 3 or 4 minutes away from qualifying and to the next round. So that attached people to the CCL. So here in Montreal, the CCL means a lot. Like when we don't put a good team on, and I'm saying we don't, I'm not the club in terms of the first team, but when the club doesn't put a good team in the Canadian Championship to make sure that you go out there and win it, the fans are off you. I remember Chalibon 2013. We played first leg in TFC, Toronto. He had, you know, we were playing a lot of games, so I put a reserve squad. I'd started that game. We lost. So everybody said, we don't take the CCL seriously. Canadian Championship, the club doesn't respect, or Marco Chalibon and the team doesn't respect the CCL. So next game, he put the proper team on the field, and we won six. It's one of the greatest nights at Saputo, where we won six, and then that's where people will come to the Montreal Impact, realize, hey, joining into the CCL, winning the Canadian Championship is important because it leads to that. And the moments, 2015 or 2009, they're fantastic. And unfortunately, we thought we were going to live some of it again in 2020 because we beat Saprissa. Okay, Olympia, we lost the first leg. But then it kind of lost its splendor at the end of the year. But CCL, you know, it's people ask me, would I prefer having to win the MLS Cup or the CCL? It's a tough question. But MLS Cup is because it's the whole year, so you know how difficult it is to finish the regular season, get into the playoffs, and win it. But CCL, it has so much emotions tied to it that you say, man, you represent CONCACAF on the world stage. It's not just locally. You're now, hey, we're the CONCACAF champions. So it's a difficult thing to say that I won't be able to say in the future, at least not as a player.
Yeah. Do you remember Moises Muñoz talking a lot of trash in that final? Him saying that like that Montreal didn't deserve to be on the field, basically, with America, and that was even after that first leg, and he doubled down in Montreal. I remember him just he was the trash-talking machine. He was the headline maker for that entire series.
Yeah, we finished the game, and they're like, yeah, this is a poor result. They did not play football. We should have beat them, and we'll beat them in Montreal. So, of course, when you talk to the team before the game, what you say, hey, the guy over there on the other team, he says that they're going to put four on us. So we started off the game really well. Then we finish, and you're like, wait, we just let the Mexican be on their high horse and actually prove it again. Even though we could say they're arrogant in the area, at the end of the day, they still beat us 4-2. Yeah, I do remember that moment. It would have been sweet had we been able to beat him and just shake his hand and say, hey, I'm sorry, but football is not just played in Mexico. It's played in U.S. and Canada, and we're able to play against you guys and match toe-to-toe.
And Moises Muñoz, by the way, is from America. He basically grew up here. But you get to say whatever you want if you win, unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly. The spoils come to the winners. History is only written by the winners.
2015, also the year of Didier Drogba. Patrice, what is the – I mean, so much has been said about Didier Drogba in Montreal, and I remember – I'll never forget the scenes in the airport when he arrived, and it's like the whole damn city showed up to welcome the man to Quebec. What is it that stands out to you about Didier and Montreal and what he both changed in the club and both – and also sort of the weight of his personality? It just felt like he was larger than life.
Yeah, no, he's a charismatic guy, great guy. Of course, when you talk about a player like that, even like Thierry, you always connect to the performances they had, Chelsea, Arsenal, and all that. But then when you have them in their locker room and you chat with them, then you see the fun guy, the guy that people don't see behind closed doors. So that was fantastic. But like you mentioned, when he arrived, I don't think nobody expected the arrival that the people showed up at the airport. And it wasn't like 100 per people, the fans, the ultras. It was thousands. I only think the only person in MLS who had an entrance like this, similar, but I don't believe it's as big, is maybe Kaká in Orlando, if I'm correct. But the rest, when he arrived, it was like the Messiah has arrived. But people are like, man, even the regular sports folks and media here were like, okay, we got to start talking about this dude because he seems to be bigger than life. And I go, do you understand who Didier Drogba is? I don't think you know his story. And with the Ivory Coast stopping the war and all that stuff. So when he arrived, it was fantastic. And then the first moment is I was sitting with him in the locker room. And so my first question was, why Montreal? Like, could have gone to L.A., could have gone to New York. I think the rumor was he was supposed to probably go to Chicago. But yeah, he said, no, I love Montreal. It's French speaking. I had a lot of friends who came to school here. The people sold the club to me. So I had a connection to it. And when I came. And then after that, yeah, it was just great laughter, banter, inviting us, the team, to his house, taking some of the academy kids into the locker room, making them dance. And then after that, you have 2 months of him scoring goal after goal after goal. So I think I mentioned it in the Mount Rushmore. Some people come with hype. They don't always deliver to the hype. He came and he delivered, especially they were like, ah, he's 38. He's coming in for a last paycheck. He's done. And then he just goes 11-11. And his first starting game was 3 goals at home. So it was perfect scenario. The only thing is we didn't win. at the end of that year. That would have been the perfect. Okay, we lost the CCL, but man, we could have won the MLS Cup. Everybody would have said, wow, what a storyline. Drogba comes, legend. They win the cup. Now, Montreal Impact, we probably would be talking about maybe as one of the good top franchises in the league. But unfortunately, our storyline is about losing games and moments where you're like, you're on the other side of the performance.
So I don't know if this is too sad, but which one hurts more than 2015 or 2016 playoffs or 2017?
I think it's 16, 20, right?
2016, yeah.
Yeah.
Me personally, yeah. 2016.
Because it's Toronto?
It's Toronto, but it's not just that. The storyline was the first team going to the MLS Cup Final, the first team to Canadian team to win the MLS Cup Final. And in our end, you had TFC, the money bank, if you could say, spent a lot of money. And this is the way of football, you know, spent a lot of football. You had Michael Bradley, who was a U.S. player, captaining the Canadian team. And then you had on our side, ownership is from Montreal. Coach was from Montreal. Captain is from Montreal. So for me, storyline to win at the end, I would have been the biggest heritage, the legacy that I could have left was that. Saying I was coached by a guy that I play with and who's a legend of the club. The ownership who spent money for the last two decades or more to promote soccer. I think if we would have won, I probably would have stopped. The only reason to play an extra year is because maybe we can reach it the next year. But it hurts because we played well in the first 60 minutes of the first game. We had them down and out. We let them back in. And even over there, we tied the game. We had it, but we took three goals from set pieces. And so you're looking back and you're like, man, I would have definitely wanted to have my name with the club, especially the club name, but attached to that being the first MLS Cup team. And I think we'd have taken Seattle in Seattle, but that's just me talking. That hurts. Yeah.
Here's me talking. Who did the measurements at Stade Olympique? Are you out there with it? Like, you remember this, right? Like,
I remember because they're a big soccer. But see, the factor is when you talk about rivalries, these are the things that make it even better. Yeah. Like, I couldn't write it. I couldn't go, hey, yeah, let's paint the lines a little bit so the referees are going to look that it's not the right distance and then we're going to redo it. I remember because Michael thought, talking about Michael Bradley, they were like, yeah, they thought we did this on purpose. I said, do you think we want to stand in the locker room for 10, 15 more minutes? We're wired. We want to be on the field. Now, this just added on fuel to the story so that when we returned to Toronto, they were like, yeah, they did it on purpose. These are the storylines that create the rivalry, that create the fire. I still to this day, I don't think we've reached that climax. It was 2016 or at least the 2015, 2016, 2017 period. It's where you always need heroes and villains. You always need a storyline of, they're doing it on purpose. TFC spending a lot of money. Montreal trying to be a different type of club structure based on people in Montreal, the club, the coach, the players, the academy, and everything. So, yeah, it hurt because I remember they asked me a question after the game, and I was like, how do you want to tell me what happened or not happened? We just lost. I felt with the guys that was on the field, that you're in the battlefield. You can't go say, oh, it's his fault. It's not fault. We all lost, and we all believed deeply that we were going to get to the final.
Who was the villain for you guys on Toronto FC? Was there one?
That's easy. You have Michael, you have Josie, and then you have a little man, Jovinko, that pummels goals and such a great player and goes down and you want to make sure. But yeah, Michael was like, I know Nicolas Martineau here at TVA called him the Lex Luthor. Ball head, part of the franchise with a lot of money. So it was interesting. And also, you know, you know, David, you've been in that hallway where you passed. They already had the setup for the trophies.
Yeah.
So when you walk by, you're like, wait a minute. Do they just think this is like we're going to hand it over? So when they lost, I was very happy. I tweeted that day. I could go to sleep peacefully, because I know if I didn't win, they didn't win.
Can I ask you, with you talked about MLS Cup and the long season and what it all takes, but you were on Montreal teams that made tournament runs, whether it's CCL or MLS playoffs, where maybe you weren't pushing for Supporters Shield throughout the year. Is there something unique about a playoff setup, about playoff games, or something that you guys tapped into? Because it felt like, you know, Nacho Piatti, you knew he was going to show up in a big playoff game where you had the Red Bulls winning Supporters Shield who couldn't get over that hump at the same time. What was it that made you guys successful?
I think the CCL, that's a lot of like stuff that happened. Can't say luck, but things, because it was a new team. All the players just joined into the team at that time. Nigel Rio Coker, Bakary Soumaré, Laurent Simard arrived. Nacho, he had only been there 6 months from 2014. But the runs in the playoffs, I would say we had a veteran team. So you had Donadel, you had guys who had lived through these moments, had played high moments, so knew how to step up for one game format, because it's a final format. You're playing, and maybe that's the only game you're going to play. Season is 34 games. It's a drag. There's ups and downs. You lose a few games. Confidence is not there. But when you get to the playoffs, to get the mindset, I think we had a team that knew how to galvanize, assemble, and be ready. And we were always underdogs. So it was, okay, nobody believes in us. Mm-hmm. So we have to believe in each other. We know we have the tools. We know we have Nacho Piatti. We have Drogba. Mancuso arrived 2016. In midfield, Donadel. We have Bernier. We have Venegas. We have the back line, Sima, Camara. So we were able to say, look, guys, we have the tools. We know in a one-game, two-game setup, we can hurt teams. And I think, is it 2016? We started against DC. And everybody, the statistics was, nobody wins away on a one playoff game. And we went there, scored four. And then nobody put us in the statistics of probability to win the cup. And then we eliminate, is it the Red Bulls? Because they had a bye. Mm-hmm. After that, nobody gave us anything. They said, oh, Toronto is the team that's going to go. Montreal didn't just eliminate Red Bulls, didn't just eliminate DC. No, Toronto's going in. So I think the great thing is Montreal, we always feel like it's always perceived that we're underdogs. And I think that fuels us. I think we live off that. I think we always, Montreal is kind of like a city where it's events, it's drama. There's things that have to happen and then that they rile us up and we use that as fuel. And in a short tournament moment, a period, I think we were really good. In a long-term season, I think we needed probably a bit younger players to prepare for the future, but also for the moments where you probably need to rest. Because look, I was 36 at the time, Drogba 37, Donadel 33. We had about 7 or 8 guys in the 30s. So, you know, the reality is in the football, you kind of got to rest. Even if they're your key guys, you have to rest them. And I go back to 2013. We had a great first half of the season, but because it was Nesta, Divayo, myself, guys were you counting on, but maybe needed rest, and you didn't have the second wave that could actually take that mantle for a few games. I think in the long run of a marathon season, we can't say we struggled, but we had ups and downs. But a tournament, now we were ready for that because we knew what it took, and we knew that we could create a surprise.
One more on the past for you, Patrice, before we get to sort of the present for the Club de Foot Montreal, as well as these top five lists we want to do with you on D mid and fullback. We've talked about all these shining lights, Didier Drogba, yourself, Nacho Piatti, on and on down the list. We've not said Marco de Vaio's name, but once you just said it. I remember when Marco got in this league, how big of a deal it was and how successful he was. You played alongside him. How good was Marco de Vaio? Why don't we talk about him more?
As they say, things in the past are usually always left a bit in the past because you're always thinking of the present or the future. But Marco Di Vaio, still to this day, nobody scored 20 goals in this at this club. People forget that 2013, he was in the third in there. Oh, I can say third or second. He didn't win the trophy, but he was in the MVP race with Robbie Keane and Mike McGee. And that year, he was pummeling goals. If he was the second half of the season, I think he scored 15 or close to 15 in the first half and 5 in the second half. So you see the influence that if he didn't score, who was going to give us the, you'd say, the victory, or at least the momentum? And as a first DP, you couldn't ask for better. Because Marco is a bit more reserved. But in terms on the field, passionate guy. And you said it when he arrived, we were like, wait a minute. Wait. Serie A player, Marco Di Vaio, playing here in Montreal? Wait. I did everything to go across the Atlantic to play in these leagues. And all these guys are coming to play in my backyard. So it was fantastic to have him. And we forget that Nesta was there too.
Yeah.
But Di Vaio was the real deal. And like I said, we still haven't. I don't know how Didier would have been had he been the whole season with us in terms of when he arrived in 2015, because he scored 11 on 11. And I think nobody has done that. But Marco scored 20. He was present. It was great to talk with him because he was a guy you can count on to help you lead the team. I repeat, but the best first DP that you can say that you can have sets the tone to say, wait. If this is DP, because I remember he arrived 2012, and a lot of people were like, we're paying this guy this much. He's not scoring that many goals. And the second year, he answered the critics. And he said, look, this is why I'm the DP. And now whatever's coming after me, this is the standard. And this is the standard people in Montreal expect. Great, we got Nacho after, so it got one level higher. But it was fantastic. And we don't talk about it because we don't seem to always relish what we've had in the past that helps us build the future.
Mm-hmm. So, look, I thought Alessandro Nesta was probably going to be an impact head coach at some point. He wasn't. Thierry Henry was, and now he's not. You spent last year working with Thierry, working with this team. Now you've moved on to different adventures, though you're still in the academy there with CF Montreal. Tell me about Thierry Henry, the head coach, how he approached the game, how he approached the team, how he approached his staff, how you guys tried to go about your business last year.
But I'm going to ask you one question. What do you remember of Thierry, the player?
I mean, I remember highlight moments because I wasn't deep in soccer at that time. I was still probably a baseball guy when he was truly at his peak. So with Arsenal, at least, I remember the highlight moments. The flick over, volley goal. I remember him on the left side.
What he transpired, more than just the skill set, like when you saw Thierry.
Oh, intensity. Just intensity.
There, that's the word. With Thierry, it's passion, it's intensity. Thierry played at the highest level, considered the best player to ever play in Premier League history. And you understand that when you're around him. You understand what pushed him. I won't say demanding because it seems like a word like, yeah, you guys have to do it. It's just he knows what it took. So he was trying to transmit that into a culture, not just at the team, but at the club. But it's great also because his mind, I think I talk about intensity, but how fast things go in his mind. And when you think of high level players, how they see the game. We always say, man, it seems like it took forever. He just saw him and you just see they're thinking so fast that they're one, two, three steps away. And as a coach, when we watched games, he identified certain situations where you're like, wait a minute, because we all look at the ball and situational. And he was like, no, let's go back. Let's see. Did you see this? And they're like, wait a minute. Oh, wait. And then you have to go back to things that necessarily don't lead directly to the one or two, three players involved into the action. So his speed of thought is impressive. And he's got a knowledge of the game and repertoire of watching games, knowing players, knowing tendencies, and transmitting that. And when you talk with him about little details, and you see, wait, this is what was going through his mind when he's playing. So now you understand, and now trying to transmit that to players that are on his team and the culture of winning. Because one thing is people forget is he played at Arsenal, he played at Barcelona, he was at Juve, even though it was a short time. And even when he was at Red Bulls, they were top of the league at the time, at least contending. So you have a guy who's accustomed to winning. And that was something that, unfortunately, we won't have him. I would have loved to have him on because I think he could cultivate that in the club where Montreal Impact was making the playoffs, not making the playoffs in the last few years was not that great. Well, you have a guy who's accustomed to that, and he can bring that culture to the first team and I think to the club. So that was Thierry. Intensity, passion, but football IQ like I've never seen.
So we could talk to you about Henri all day. But there is now a job opening in Montreal. You're up there. For us who aren't, what do you think happens with that? How would you like to see that handled?
Look, Olivier Renard's phone is probably ringing a lot. People telling me, I got a coach for you, coach that.
Weeby can coach.
No, Andrew? No, don't even. Yeah. Whoa. Time out. I got to be in my basement here in Kansas City. Nice. Man.
So, Olivier built a team with Thierry in the last year. You could see in terms of the acquisitions, what the team got younger. Things are moving forward where you go, okay, every purchase, every player brought makes sense. Every ladder's ticking. Now, getting a new coach, you're asking a question, do you want to go get somebody abroad that's going to come in? And let's not forget, probably we'll have to quarantine for 2 weeks. So that means not even really see your own team the first 2 weeks. And potentially the team will have to probably be on the road like the end of last season. And now do you want continuity? Somebody that's internal, players already know, have a trust in, has similar mindset or in terms of philosophy as Thierry and maybe connects to Olivier Renard. And now Olivier Renard will have to take that decision. Maybe there's other people he knows that are there. But Wilfried Nancy seems to tick some of the boxes. I know him personally. I know his frame of mind. He's been at the club for several years. He said it in a press conference. I've learned a lot from the last few coaches. And I go back. Jim Curtins, he was an assistant coach. Bumped in. Yeah, fires 5 years later. Coach of the year. Team prosperous. Brian Schmetzer, same thing. You can compare the clubs. They're different, stuff like that. But I mean, when you look at it, there's been assistants who've taken on the job and done well. And the way the club is going in terms of the players that they brought in, the roster, Wilfried Nancy seems to fit where, okay, let's give this guy a shot and see. But who knows? The names are going out there. Patrick Vieira, would he be interested in coming back to MLS? He left to go in Europe. Other names that are there that are available. Renard has a decision to make, but having been with Wilfried, I feel that he understands the club. He's got a great soccer mind, and for the players also, it wouldn't be too much of a change. Thierry's gone, so it's like, okay, we understand he's leaving, but now what's next? Who's coming in? Competition, do I still have a spot? No. What's the philosophy? And with Wilfried, it seems like it would at least follow itself from what Thierry brought in and with Olivier Renard building this team for the future.
TBD right now for the Club de Foot Montreal. I keep going. I almost say it. It's just such a habit for me with those old school impact teams. Let's do something a little different to end this with you, Patrice. Consider this an open debate, let's call it. We're doing top fives for 8 different positions in Major League Soccer. The 5 best players that play that position. We're going to try to narrow them down before the season starts, give you sort of a list of the elite, the guys that you want to watch if you're on a Saturday and you're thinking, what am I going to check in on? Oh, I really want to see. Let's just say Ryan Hollingshead play fullback for FC Dallas because he's so darn good at it. We're going to start with defensive midfield in this exercise. We're also going to do goalkeeper, center back, box-to-box midfield, tens, wingers, kind of general attackers, and number nines. So today we'll do D-mids and fullbacks. Let's start in the midfield. Patrice, for you, what is a defensive midfielder in this iteration of the game? Because I think that's maybe the place to start here because it can get a little bit debatable about roles, about positions, about formations. In your mind, defensive midfield in Major League Soccer, what are the hallmark characteristics? Who are the sort of players we're thinking about?
First and foremost, yeah, I got to go with like the old school guard because when you say D-mid, it's guys who have volume, cover ground, recover the ball, and can play the ball because a lot of guys can break the plays, but not everybody has the qualities or has that in their repertoire to be able to take the ball and then, okay, I can create some offense also. So I'm thinking Ozzy Alonso, having played against him, and he's still really good. You see, okay, he left Seattle. But you see what he brings to Minnesota. You saw he maybe doesn't play the whole year because, yeah, he's a bit older. But he recovers the ball. He's in passing lanes. He can drive the ball with himself. and he can find passes that break lines. So I always thought Ozzie had a lot more to give than just what we talk about, the defensive mid position. Then you have Diego Chara, definitely probably the leader of the pack, because it just seems like he's never tired. He's getting older, but it just seems like he's still everywhere. Portland plays a lot of, at least four or five guys go forward, even himself sometimes, but he's there. I still remember one action, I don't know if it's last year or the year before, where he's at his 18-yard box, and he's the one creating a counterattack. And then going back to his position, just has an engine that you just, and he's getting older, but you just seems not to slow down. And he's always there. I think he was in Team of the Year. Unfortunately, the funny thing is he's not been at the All-Star only for once, which is a funny thing. Maybe because in terms of, is he not as pretty as Ozzy in terms of making the ball play, because there's always been guys in front of him that Diego or Blanco that kind of take the offensive star shining moments away from what he does. That's Diego. Then after that, you have Alexander Ring in New York City FC. I think that's really interesting. He's clean. He plays great. Two touches. Now, last year, they kind of made him play a little bit more advanced, but he's still valuable to that team. And you understand when he arrived, why they signed him on a long-term deal, because he still connects the dots. They got younger players, but he's still the one connecting the dots. He's a versatile player. Can shoot, can go into the box, got so much things in his repertoire. I love Alexander Ring because those are the guys that the teams tick when they're on the field. When they're not there, it's still a team playing, but you just don't feel it's the same presence, the same they don't dominate as well.
Let me get you my top five here, and you guys can try to rip it apart. I'm going my top five D-mids in Major League Soccer for 2021. We have not yet seen a ball kicked, so this can obviously change and change rather quickly. Injuries can affect it, etc. But number one for me, Edward Atuesta, LAFC. You mentioned sort of when you don't see them in the team and how the team changes. We always talk about Carlos Vela and the injury he had last year. Well, Edward Atuesta, that might have been even more of an impact injury for LAFC than was Vela. It's the metronome part of it, which he is so incredible at. There are still places, as we saw in the playoffs, that he can get better as far as sort of the defensive recovery and positioning side, but it is almost there, and he does everything at such a high level, and it fits so well in LAFC's system that I gotta have him number one. At number two, it's the timeless, the ageless, the ever smiling, ever running Diego Chara. He's got to be in that top three for me. Here's where I start to get a little iffy. I love Ozzy. Ozzy's the man. Is Ozzy in 2021, with what you mentioned, Patrice, and maybe you jump in here, Dave, on me and correct me, I don't think he's in my top five just because of the amount of minutes and the amount of miles that you can put on his legs throughout an entire season. I feel like there are guys that'll play basically every minute for their team that you would have to push in higher just because, you know, that consistency, that availability is what really changes teams.
And to Patrice's point, he probably is still the guy you'd take to start a playoff game for you. And when Minnesota gets to the playoffs, he may be one of the five most impactful D-mids in a playoff run. But throughout the season, I agree with you. I don't know that he's the starter week in and week out for them. Hassani Dotson might push in there. Some other guys. Will Trapp's now there as well. So I agree with what both of you said. I don't have him in my top five because I don't know how many minutes I'm going to get from him. We're into controversial territory, though.
I know, because the top two, I feel like, just flow off your tongue, and then you're like, ah, man, I really want to put Gaston Jimenez in here in the top five.
Wait, is this in order, or are you just saying names?
The top two are in order, and now the last three I'm trying to,
Patrice,
like,
already hit my number three, which is Alex Ring. So I agree with Patrice. He does everything on the ball. He's versatile if you want him to, but I think in Austin, he's going to be a true six, with two eights in front of him or a 10, whatever it is. And he can stop play. He can recreate attack, whatever he needs to do. He does all those things. And he's so clean in possession that he can take it under pressure. He can take it off his center backs, whatever you need. So he's my number three. So Patrice and me have a similar list.
Okay. I will accept Alex Ring as the third on this list. I'm fine with that. Now here's where it gets hard, because I have three players that I think, you know, with, look, James Sands, respect to him, signed a new contract today. I think he should be in the conversation. Maybe he will be after this year. Got to stay healthy. Santiago Sosa could be really good. Gregore down in Miami could be amazing. His resume is sterling. So I'm going to throw out maybe it's more like five names, and you can hack some off if you feel that way. Jose Martinez, Union. Gaston Jimenez, Fire. Judson in San Jose. Dax McCarty, and then Anders is probably screaming at me, Jao Paulo in Seattle. Now, I know you can debate on Jao Paulo because he had Svensson there next to him to play that six and that stay home six, and that's when they're at their best. But when you think about that group, are there any that you automatically say, okay, well, great player, all respect to them, but not in my top five?
Patrice?
I'll go the other way. I'll say Jose Martinez. Definitely I had him on because I didn't know who he was. But as I watched games, the question in Philly was, is he going to replace, how are we going to replace Harris Medjugjanin? And he fit in perfectly in terms of the style of play Union, the Union want to play. Aggressive, volume, play the ball, go forward, press. So I think he slotted in very well and puts himself in the top five after his season last year. And you already put the guy that I enjoy watching is probably the first one I enjoy watching, which is Eduardo Atuesta. Then after that, yeah, you have Dax that still doing in Nashville, yep. New team, still there, does his job, still off set pieces, even though he's not big. He's a dangerous man to watch. And I think a team like Nashville tick because, yes, Zimmerman at the back, but because Dax is there and he's, you know, he's Dax. He's abrasive sometimes with the guys on the field, but you need that. But he's calm. He gives you, like, if I give Dax the ball, it's not going to be lost. You're going to bring it forward. You have trust in that player in the center of the park.
Yeah. Who's number five? I'm down with Jose Martinez to go number four.
I think we all agree there. The number five one, all of this is why I'm losing my hair. Just kidding. But it all kills me. And it's all stressing me out. I agree with what Patrice says about Dax, and I think he's still doing it at a high level. I don't question anything, but in Nashville, it did feel like Godoy sits next to him, and he doesn't have to cover as much ground as some of these other guys. He doesn't have to do as much, and also they're not as expansive in possession, so he doesn't step forward like we saw him in New York at times. Gaston Jimenez is another really good shout. I fell with Jao Paulo as my fifth player, and I know the positional stuff, and if Roldan's next to him this year, which one of them is more the sixth, but it's the best spine in MLS, probably still. Maybe Columbus is pushing that. He stepped in and was a major part of that, and you remember even early in the year, even though they lost in CCL, Nico wasn't even there, and it was Jao Paulo that was running that team. And so what he can do in possession, taking it off center backs, and what Patrice said about Dax, the same, where you know he's not going to lose the ball. He's press-averse, so you can play through him. All those things and his versatility. He's my fifth guy, but there's about 13 guys below him that I feel really bad.
Yeah, it's painful. That's it. Number one, Edward Atuesta.
Yeah, exactly, because he makes the team tick. Yeah, of course, the style of play suits to his game, but and I think there's a stats that says he's one of the first or number one player that plays the ball forward and his team creates more attack because of that. And that's the thing I love about midfielders is, yes, everybody can play east to west, but how can you play the ball that breaks lines and allows your team to go forward? How often do you do that? And Eduardo Atuesta is in the top of that, if not number one.
All right. Atuesta one, Char two, Rings three, we had Jose Martinez four, and we're ending with Jao Paulo at five. Argue with us. We'll put this out on Twitter. Dave, we assigned you fullbacks. So give me David Goss's top five fullbacks in Major League Soccer for 2021. We did not do left and right back, which is just yet
more disrespect. Because no one respects fullbacks.
Yet more disrespect for fullbacks. But you can hash that out with us in the mailbag if you would like. 401-206-0MLS, extratimeinmlssoccer.com. Give me your top five. Run us through them. We'll just step back and let you pontificate, man.
So number one, I had Anton Tinnerholm. I think that, to me, felt like the safe pick of he's the best all-around fullback. He's aggressive offensively. He's clean in possession. He can create chances. And he's pretty locked down defensively. I voted him in my defensive player of the year voting. I think he was the only fullback in that conversation.
Yeah.
So he was one. What's interesting about this list before I continue on is I was surprised by how many left backs I actually had closer in this list because of how long it's been since there's been any quality at that position. in the league. Number two, I had Ryan Hollingshead, which a lot of people, because I've talked to people around the league about this list, a lot of people didn't even have him on the list. They didn't know, is he a right back this year or a left back? Is he a midfielder like he did in the playoffs? To me, all of that is in positive, that he's an all-star left back and he can do all those things. I had Kai Wagner, number three, who it seems like is coming back with Philly. There was rumors of him going to EPL for a reason. And I really like what he can do in possession. And he was such a key piece for Philly when they get narrow, for him to get forward and create chances for those two forwards. Now I've got about 75 guys for my last two spots. I'm going to stick with one that I appreciate a lot. And we've talked to just with Tony Beltran this week about Aaron Herrera. And I'm going to put him in my list. I think he's as tough defensively as there is in this league. And you've seen him as RSL, when they have better pieces around him, get forward, be in possession, be dangerous offensively. And then number five is really, really tough.
Yeah,
do you want me to list off some of the names?
Here, how about that's my job on this show.
Okay.
I just list names, right?
Yeah,
that's what I normally
do.
Harrison Offal, Milton Valenzuela, Sam Vines, Roman Metiner, Ali Adnan, Richie Larea, Juan. Trying to think of some other ones that I would throw in there that would be in the running for this list. Those are
Adam Lundqvist.
Adam Lundqvist in Houston would definitely be there. Aro could maybe have a shout with this one. I don't Nuhu. You could throw Nuhu in here.
Someone,
no doubt. I think Alex Lima, who just got traded over. Yeah, Nick Lima just got traded over to Austin. He's going to be a starter and maybe in a better position with a coach that trusts him a little bit more than it seemed like Almeida did at times.
And then you
those
have
are
to
just
throw
some names. Claudio Bravo.
Then you have to throw in the unknowns, which is new acquired players. So Claudio Bravo in Portland, they're so excited about him at left back. Kim Moon-Hwan at LAFC, who seems like he'll be the starting right back for that team. Jose Van Rinken as well in Portland. The other one I put in my unknowns is Tejan Buchanan.
Yeah.
Because it was awesome in the playoffs, but we've only seen him do it for 3-4 weeks. Right? And so is he a winger, Patrice?
He going to stay there? Because he's a winger in terms of his official starting position and what got him to the MLS. But he just demonstrated that he could be the new wage type of. It makes Bruce Arena have a like, wow, man, had they done this earlier, you know, with all the offensive tools, he found a way to get an offensive tool on the field and play at a position that maybe wasn't his. And now we discover that, hey, when you attack, you don't have to defend as much, but he has the athleticism to be able to get there. And he could potentially become the best right back in the league.
Yeah, him and Richie Larea are sort of in a similar spot, whereas Richie's done it for a lot longer in that position, though not a long, long time, because he's a recent transition there too. If Nico Figal plays all season for Miami at right back, that could be another one.
No,
we've named
stop.
All the names, Dave.
Stop.
Give me
Figal
number five.
Not on this list.
Give me number five. I just threw it out there.
Yeah, I know. This is really tough for me. I think I came down to Juan, Richie Larea, and to your point, I need to see Richie do it defensively for another year. I need to see that he is a fullback and not just a converted attacker playing out there. Same with Tejan, and maybe they'll be on this list at the end of the year. And in Lundqvist, who his numbers are off the charts, and Houston was unwatchable at times, and they were better in some ways at times, and he was a star for them when we talked about Salcedo in the first segment and what he could bring to that back line and help him. But I'm going to fall where I started, which is Juan.
Okay.
I think he might be the best attacking fullback for a two-way player, right? He brings as much as he brings to the attack, but he's still not a defensive liability, where, like we talked about with Tejan and Richie, they are attacking players starting at that position. So, yeah.
The question I add is because in the modern game, fullbacks or can't say forwards, but attacking weapons, especially everybody now has inverted wingers. So Richie Larea, maybe you could say, and I got to give a Toronto guy some props. It's difficult, but yeah, I think he surprised us all because, of course, I don't think that's his original position. But he made it like he made me think of the time Bittershore and Morrow were passing to each other as right and left back. And he was a tool that when he came on, even if he wasn't starting, when he came on, teams were like, oh, wait a minute. Now we're going to have a guy who's going to fly on the wing and he could actually potentially go and brought, I know against us, cost us penalties. Fullbacks, yes, you have to defend, but most of the ones and the best in the world, why do we love them? It's because they're offensive players. Why do people love Alphonso Davies? That's why I would put Richie Larea. But one is he has to be in there, but I would put Richie Larea in there also.
So you know what? If Patrice goes out on a limb for a Toronto guy, he gets in the list. Oh. Richie Larea, number five. Oh,
number five. There you have it. We'll put it out on Twitter. Patrice, always a legend. He's doing his thing at TVA, writing blogs every single week. He's on the radio with them. He's going to be a part of their broadcasts and coaching in the CF Montreal Academy as well. Patrice Bernier, an absolute legend in North American soccer. Let's get to the mailbag. 401-206-0MLS. Extra time at MLSsoccer.com. We're talking about fullbacks. Well, we got some news around fullbacks and a favorite of the show, Ray Gatis. He has decided to retire after 9 years with the Philadelphia Union. You got the feeling, Dave, that Ray was preparing for this future, right? When we talked to him on this show, I can't even remember now when we talked to him in 2020.
I think it was during MLS's back.
Yeah.
Or right after.
Yeah, he was had his hands on a lot of things at the club, had his mind in a lot of places that were, let's say, bigger than soccer. So congratulations to Ray Gatis on an amazing career, and whatever it is that he's going to do next, we'll be there to see how that goes. And it leads us to this question from Mike Donovan on Twitter: who is the best outfield player in MLS history to never score a goal in the league? I went to the incomparable Rick Laws here at Major League Soccer, who is the stats guru. Anything you need, he can give it to you. And Lord knows he gave this one to me. I said, I need players who have played at least 150 games in this league and have not scored a goal. Are you looking at the rundown right now, Dave? Are you seeing these names?
I have seen the list already.
Okay, so I can't play guessing game with you.
Sorry.
Number one, Jason Hernandez, 293 games, no goals. Brandon Perdue, that's a throwback name. Some of you will remember it. 252 games, no goals. Ray Gatis, third on this list, 221 games, zero goals. Should have waited to get your first one, right? Maybe that was never coming, though. Danny O'Rourke, 200 games, no goals. You got Chris Leach, 196. Carlos Mendez, 158. And Rusty Pierce, 155. Who is the best player on this list, in your opinion? No goals in their MLS career, more than 150 games.
These are good players. These are players that were part of really good teams and were key parts of it. Jason, for one, right? He was part of the Goonies. He was part of some of the San Jose good teams. Ended up, now he's in Toronto.
Yeah.
Actually, on the front office side. I'm going to go with Ray Gatis, not just because he retired today. I've always been a huge Ray Gatis fan. I think he quietly was a top five right back in this league for a number of years when he wasn't even a starter on the depth chart coming into the season. And he continued to win that spot and win that spot and win that spot. Carlos Mendez, a Long Island legend. So
yeah, I knew you were going there.
LI, baby. But yeah, I'm going Ray.
Yeah, Daniel O'Rourke was on those good crew teams back in the day. Now an agent, I believe, in these MLS parts. Brandon Perdue, those fire teams, playoff teams back in the day, he was on those teams. I think I would probably go Jason Hernandez here just because he was a big part of what we would consider one of the best teams in MLS history in the Goonies and had the longevity to go along with the lack of goal scoring. So I'd go Jason Hernandez, but you can't go wrong anywhere with these. The MLS Aces podcast had this question out there. It wasn't
another
for
Long
us.
Another legend, by the way.
But I'm claiming it. Who is?
The MLS Aces podcast.
Oh, they're Long Islanders? Yeah. Oh, nice. Yeah. All right, heading into 2021, there are 14 clubs who have not won an MLS Cup. Of the 14 clubs, who has the best shot at winning one in 2021? You got Austin, of course, Cincinnati, duh.
You're really going to read a list of 14 names in
sure, just fine. Just name your team that you think has the best chance. I mean, it's LAFC, right? They're the one that haven't won it. But how about an original? Give me an original that you think.
I think it's the Revs.
Yeah, yeah.
Eastern Conference that's the Championship. Original. Carlos Heel healthy this year. They seem to have gotten the D-mid they needed. Feels like they've kind of settled their fullback positions as well. They have a ton of depth. So they're maybe an attacking piece away from being where they want to be, but they still made an Eastern Conference Finals run last year, and they haven't lost a major part of that team.
I would go in my rankings here. One, LAFC. Two, I would go with the Revs because of the Bruce Arena effect and just the depth and level of talent and the run that they made. Three, I would say Orlando City. Four, I would go with the Union. Maybe last year was their opportunity. Maybe they'll prove us all wrong. We'll look stupid. We'll be like, oh, yeah, well, they just reloaded Aronson and McKenzie out. They just got it back. But those would be kind of the top four. And then five is just a revolving door. I want to see Dallas be that team. I don't know if they will be. I want to see Inter Miami be resurgent. I hope that they will be for entertainment reasons, but I just don't know.
I feel pretty confident in Dallas. I think they're a really strong team this year. I think the center back upgrade is going to be good. We hope that whatever these young pieces are healthy, but they have so many options. So I think Dallas will be in the conversation most of the season.
All right, we end here. Nathan J. Hill, what should we name the inevitable Austin-Dallas rivalry? You know how we feel about creating rivalries here at Extra Time. We don't want to do it, but it is our duty. I'm just kidding. I got some behind the scenes on this one from Dallas resident. Says, I think Austin will be the Vancouver of the Texas Derby. The main rivalry will still be Dallas-Houston, but Austin is still there like a little brother. The sense I've gotten from fans and staff of the clubs is they'll just be just fine if it's just part of the Texas Derby, or they hope that's what will eventually happen. I think that's a good shout. If you got a name for this potential rivalry, Austin-Dallas, hit us up. We will talk about it on Monday with Doyle, 401-206-0MLS. Big thanks to Produce Brannier. Big thanks to you, Dave. And, of course, thanks to Produce and Anders for keeping us on track with time. He says we have to go. Boo! We'll see you on Monday, everybody.